Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Why are you following me?
The stuff you wear is inappropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. So none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
What we do on this podcast that we host is every week Richard and I break down the latest episode of some show that we are currently watching or obsessing over. Perhaps right now we are watching HBO's We Are Who We Are. We are on episode 5. So this episode, we will cover all of episode 5 and nothing beyond that, because we have not watched beyond that. So that's as far as we're going. Just a little bit of business is that there will be an extra still watching in your feed this week. On Tuesday, there's sort of a special one-off bonus episode. Anthony Bresnikan joined me to talk about The Haunting of Bly Manor, the Netflix series. So we talked about all of it at once in one podcast. There's like a spoiler-free section at the beginning if you're like, do I think I want to watch it? I don't know. Let me hear what Anthony and Joanna have to say. So there's a spoiler-free section there, and then we get into sort of our large review. So don't be alarmed or surprised if you see, or spooked if you see a Haunting of Bly Manor episode. And then Richard and I will be back next Monday with episode 6 of We Are Who We Are. And then if you want to hear Richard's thoughts on The Haunting of Bly Manor, we talked about it on Little Gold Men as well. So, you know, a lot of ghost talk this week.
And you can read my review.
And you can read his review. And you can read my article, on it about, I read a bunch of Henry James stories and talked about them. So, you know, all kinds of wall-to-wall Bly, but we are not here to talk about ghosts. We're here to talk about American teens in Italy. We've got a couple emails. We've got some great emails. So thank you guys so much. We're at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. You can email us there. The emails have been fantastic this season. And, I was just telling Richard off air, like I'm surprised and dazzled because I wasn't sure how much engagement there would be around the show. So thank you guys for watching it and discussing it with us.
Yeah, it's really nice to know that there are other people on the other end of this conversation.
Yeah, exactly.
Listening. Thank you guys.
Chris sent us, a listener named Chris sent us a couple emails. One of the emails he sent pointed out that the series finale is on November 2nd, the day before Election Day. Ugh. I don't think that's a coincidence. As Sarah Paulson famously once said, let me know what you think. So I do think it's a coincidence, actually, but what do you think, Richard?
Do people know what that Sarah Paulson reference is?
I don't. What is it?
I think it's because a good friend's podcast called Who Weekly covered this, so I listened to that. So someone posted either like a grid of like Sarah Paulson roles and said, like, you know, she has the range or whatever. And Kristen Chenoweth responded to that account saying, I think it was Evan Ross Katz posted it. And then Sarah Paulson replied to that, And so it was just, sort of created this like celebrity drama about like, well, Sarah Paulson played a version of Chenoweth on Studio 60 in the Sunset Trip because Chenoweth dated Aaron Sorkin and is sort of conservative. Yeah. Anyway, so that's what the is about. Didn't mean to derail into celebrity
gossip. No, I appreciate it. I was like, this is probably from a season of American Horror Story that I didn't watch, but that's much better, a much better answer. So thank you. So election day eve, coincidence or not? What do you think, Richard?
I wish that, I mean, it's great timing, but I think the way that Labor Day was late this year and it was an eight episode series and they just, that was 8 weeks.
Yeah.
That's what I think.
That's what I think too. There was a lot of background election chatter in this episode 5 that really stressed me out, so it's definitely on my mind as we watch this series. Okay, Veronica wrote in, she had a different interpretation of a moment from the party episode last week. So this is from Veronica, who says, I thought the moment from the most recent episode when Frasier tells Harper he kissed the girl at the party and they say, don't do that again, might have had a different meaning. For the audience, there is ambiguity around Frasier's sexuality, other than an apparent crush on Jonathan. But maybe Harper knows something we don't. Maybe Frasier explicitly told Harper that he's gay or that they are inferring that he is, and therefore the response was expressing disappointment that he kissed someone he did not really want to kiss just because he felt pressured to do so. Or even regardless of his sexual identity, Frasier was obviously not into the girl's advances throughout the night, yet he eventually conformed and kissed her back. Harper's response might have a hint of possessiveness, but I think they were also annoyed by Frasier betraying what seemed like an understanding between the two that they will be true to themselves regardless of anyone's opinions of them. Love the podcast. Thank you. What do you think of Veronica's assessment, Richard?
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And I think it's a richer read of that moment from last episode. And also one that I would say in the really, I think, wonderfully articulated scenes in this episode where you really see their friendship in its really intimate the way that it works when it's just them behind closed doors. I think it makes a lot more sense that she would have a kind of disappointment with him violating some sort of friend contract rather than her feeling jealous at that party.
I think you're right. All right, I'm really excited about this.
Well, I think the emailer is right.
Right, and I think you're right to concur. Yeah. I concur with both of you. All right, I'm really excited about this email because it comes all the way from Italia. I apologize to all of Italy for that accent. All right, so this comes from Giovanni. And Giovanni says, Luca Guadagnino might have... and then parentheses not answer the question on how to call Caitlin/Harper in the Italian Vanity Fair, saying that the show is explicitly uninterested in labels, hence the name, embracing confusion and trying to move past our need to define our own identities through conventions rooted in schematic conservative ideas on gender. That language shouldn't be the main power structure shaping who we are. She's Caitlin until he's Harper, or she, they are both Caitlin and Harper. We don't really know. Choosing to call her Harper before she asks us to is not what the show wants to do. The politics and ideas driving the show are probably more nuanced than that. This is first and foremost, and this is interesting because this is like a, this is me, Joanna, talking. This is sort of like a rookie mistake we do sometimes when we talk about television. Increasingly, I think we talk about television as almost like an auteur type of thing, and especially when there's like a film director who we identify at the helm of it. So I think we've been talking about this purely. You mentioned his collaborators in the first episode by name, but we've been talking about this a lot as a Luca Guadagnino property. So here's some extra information from Giovanni. He says, this is first and foremost Francesca Manieri's show. She's a screenwriter with a background in philosophy and queer slash feminist activism. In the past, she has closely followed the work of queer theorist and trans man Paul B. Preciado, whose work she has analyzed in essays and adapted for theater. I'm too ignorant to know what that means in terms of her own ideas on the topic and how they'll mix with her lived experience of queer coming of age, but she definitely brings to the project something more than fast fashion opinions. Guadagnino and Manieri came to the show driven by very different urges. Luca looking to further explore the coming of age genre with a News and More by Pielat as his main source of inspiration. Francesca from a researched, intellectual, and personal point of view on gender and queer identities. I won't be surprised if the resulting work will end up being closer to a companion piece to Celine Sciamma's own exploration on gender and sexuality, rather than something that can fit the more rigid schemes through which gender is currently being talked about on American media. Giovanni. And then Giovanni said something really nice after that, a nice PS, just so maybe we didn't think that they were scolding us in any way, which I didn't feel that they were. I thought this was incredibly interesting. I would love to dust off my very rusty college Italian and try to read this Luca piece that was in the Italian Vanity Fair. But this is really illuminating to me in terms of the dual approaches that are at play here on the show. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah, I didn't know that, and I guess I could have done some homework. I think the tricky thing is, and not to defend ourselves, but like it's hard with writing in TV shows and movies. It's really hard to know who contributed what because it's not broken down for you. Mm-hmm. And because Guadagnino has a writing credit on each one, and he directed every episode, and it's sometimes billed as Luca Guadagnino's "We Are Who We Are," I think we were kind of using Guadagnino maybe as a shorthand, for the creators of the show. But I think, I guess we could be more cognizant of like the fact that there are two other writers, Manieri and Giordano, on every single one of these episodes.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think I think Giovanni's just not telling us we did wrong, but just sort of this is added info probably from that Vanity Fair article. Vanity Fair. What kind of reputable magazine is that? And that's fascinating to me. This idea that there is because I was curious. I don't know how interested Guadagnino has been in something that feels so boundaryless, you know what I mean? Like, Call Me By Your Name is obviously remarkable, you know, for being a fairly mainstream, you know, gay love story. Like, that was groundbreaking in its own way. But I don't, from the films of his that I've seen, I don't think of him as, like, quite into gender or sexual theory the way that I do think is kind of evident in this show. So, I think it's really cool, and I would be interested to know what the third artistic voice brings to the table as well.
Yeah,
other than a great Instagram feed, as you mentioned earlier, Richard. So, So thank you so much to Giovanni. I welcome any and all emails from Italy and elsewhere. And then this last email comes from Joel, and Joel writes in to say, thanks for covering the show. I really enjoy your podcast. Listening to your great perspectives adds to my viewing experience. I wanted to comment on the music, and specifically the piece being played during the end of the paintball scene when paintball is over but stuff starts flying. The music is by composer John Adams, and it's called Short Ride in a Fast Machine. On the podcast, you alluded to entering the military machine, and this really made me think about the choice of music for the scene, and that it was very intentional. It really gave me an energy to the scene that made me really pay attention to the chaotic revelry that was going on. It set the tone of the episode for me. And then Joel went on to say that he agreed with me that he was like watching the party scene with like euphoria lenses, really scared that someone was going to get hurt, and glad that no one did. All right. So, and thanks for our coverage. So yeah, I mean, what's interesting, we talked about this with some of the other song choices in last week's episode that felt like a little on the nose. It was like Soldier of Love and like, you know, Lay Down Your Arms and all the stuff that felt like a little on the nose. And I wasn't sure if I was like, not in a bad way, just sort of like, I feel like usually when it comes to music design in film and television, filmmakers and TV creators as artistically rich as this don't usually pick like the most obvious song. But that being said, watching this week's episode, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the song that like Jonathan starts air guitaring to, the lyrics are "Let's spend the night together," right? This Rolling Stones.
I think so. Yeah, you're better at the music stuff than I am, but yeah,
I'm pretty sure that's what happened. I was like, okay, I guess we are just doing like on. I guess we're just doing text, no subtext, just text. So maybe we can keep our ears open for other like very textual music cues in the show going forward.
Yeah, and I it's funny actually. Short Ride on the Fast Machine was a crossword clue in a crossword I did the other day, like an old New York. So that's really weird convergence of things. But you know, it the machine. Like, you know, we had talked about like the machine of the military and all that stuff. But it's also the body, and it's what is adolescence but a short ride on a fast machine. You know, and I think that it's not at all an accident that this episode begins in a whole different season, you know, like,
yeah,
like that party episode was not just the end for one boy going off to be deployed, but something in this whole show has shifted. And so maybe we're on a new short ride on a different fast machine, or I don't know what, but we're definitely something, an end point of some sort was reached last week, and now we're starting, I think, a new thing in some ways.
Yeah, because I mean, that felt like a summer episode, right?
Yeah, late summer, kind of like that last hurrah thing. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And this is a very blustery fall. I loved the use of weather in this episode. I thought it was great. It's funny because when we started talking about the show, we were like, this isn't a show that you can predict things for. But I can't remember if I said it on the podcast. I can't imagine I didn't, because where else would I be talking about the show? That I was like, I don't think that hair on Harper's head is going to stay very long.
I think you said that on the podcast, yeah.
And so, right. I was like, yeah. And then when I saw Harper like watching someone else get their hair cut in this episode, I was like, oh, it's coming. The clippers are coming. So thanks to the wind, I think is what tipped us over.
You know what would have been really fun? if they played the Madonna Power of Goodbye from Felicity while she was getting her hair cut.
Is that what plays during Felicity's famous haircut?
No, but like that was like the Felicity song, as I think, like during all the ads on the WB. So I just associate that song with Felicity.
Yeah.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the haircut? Do you want to start at the beginning of the episode? Where do you want to be?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, let's talk about the haircut and what that represents for Kate/Harper. You know, this episode was so plot heavy,
yeah,
in a way that was kind of not that I mind the other episodes that are a little bit more, you know, nonlinear and just sort of dreamlike and whatever. But it was nice that this show can also do like every scene, something significant happens,
yeah.
You know, and I think in some ways the most significant stuff happens to Kate, because we really see in several different ways their continued exploration of their gender identity, and whether or not the cutting her, you know, huge mane of hair, that might signify just like, I want to have a different style, but obviously it signifies more in terms of going on this date. But yeah, I think that you were right to see that that was like a clear, like, I don't know, semiotic hint that there was a big change coming. And then that this was the episode where we got it.
It's interesting too, because, you know, Frasier in so many ways is like miles ahead of okay, I'm just going to call them like by every other pronoun and name just to keep it fun. Miles ahead of Harper in terms of like certain things that he knows about trans identity and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised when he was like, "You are your hair. It's what everyone loves yeah. about you." I was like, what an incredibly, I think, insensitive, you know, and I know that we know that Frasier can be incredibly insensitive, but like on this subject, he's been so good that I was really surprised by that, you know?
But I also think like it felt real. I mean, I loved that bedroom scene. And then when they're like kind of shrieking and laughing
yeah.
and when they're cutting Harper's hair, because it's just like such a huge deal. They're kids. They are still kids. And I think the obsession with the band that Frasier's watching on this phone, and it's like these kids are like, I mean, certainly more aware of the world and its variants than I was at that age, but like there is a naivete there, and so much of what they're doing is the first time they've done it, the first time they've talked about anything like this out loud,
yeah.
the first time they've seen this band, the first time they've heard this song, and I think with that is going to come. You know, some broader understanding of what gender identity might mean doesn't always catch up with the immediate reactive, but like your hair is your hair, you know, like, and I think it's really great that scene balanced those two things. If these kids were a little bit too precocious and knowing and said all the right things every
True.
Single time, it would be a little moralizing. It would be a little bit starchy, you know, but in this case, we get to see them kind of like leap forward while also like dropping some things as they go, you know.
I need to look this up. You know, I'm sorry, I didn't have a chance to see if this information is out there already, but that scene was so like joyous and energetic that I almost wonder if that was the actor's real hair getting cut.
It kind of felt like it, didn't it?
It felt like it, yeah. Yeah. I love the framing of Frasier standing behind her with his arm around her, like, and her holding on and him just wielding the clippers. Like, it was just so, like, just so sweet. It was such an act of, like, love and support and, like, and youthful joy and just, like, holy shit, we're doing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the Frasier laugh was just so funny because it was just like that liminal teen boy, like, if I raise my voice too much, my voice is going to crack. And, you know, it's just like a funny, funny sound.
I have a follow up question for you.
Yeah.
They then hide almost all of the hair, not all of it.
Yeah. Poorly.
Yeah. So first of all, very poorly. Take it all the way out of the house. Secondly, yeah. Why are there three trash cans in their kitchen? Why did Richard have three places he could check? I mean, I suppose one of them could be recycling. But I was like, he checked under the sink and then over by the water cooler and then next to the one by the water cooler. And I was like, Richard, how many trash cans do you have? How many does one man need?
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. Also, like, that toilet was filthy.
Oh,
and
yes.
It's just like, clean your house, sir.
Well,
like,
okay, let's get to my favorite part of this episode, which is that twist I did not see coming, though kind of like hoped for it in my heart of hearts, I guess, that like, I don't usually root necessarily for extramarital affairs, but like when Jenny and Maggie are hooking up,
mm-hmm.
I wrote it in all caps with like excitement in my notes. I thought it was great because I'm like, oh, the two characters who I think are really nice who get like shit on by their spouses are having joyful sex together. That's great. I'm here for it. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, not to question your detective skills, Joanna, but like one of these episodes ended with them sticking their fingers into a pie together.
That's true.
What did you think was going to happen?
I didn't think, yeah. I honestly thought it would take Jenny at least longer to get there. So,
but I know what you mean. And I think that the way that sometimes when characters, who, especially ones from cultures, not of the people who created the thing that that character is in. I think there's a lot of like, well, but she's from Nigeria and she might be a little repressed and here would be all this and it's a homophobic country and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I like that it didn't bother with that. It was just like, maybe some of that hemming and hawing happened. And there is a slight conversation about, you know, Nigeria in this episode. But like, I really like, as the show continues to do, we meet this relationship while it's already happening, you know, like, and I think that what that does is really afford Jenny her more of a, she's less of a plot device and just a person within the story, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that like, you know, and from a sort of cynical, like, TV movie perspective, I'm like, okay, so like Alice Braga like read some scripts and was like, this is coming for my character later. Yeah. And like, cause like I was like, she's kind of famous, like this, you know, as a 70, like it's interesting that they're doing this show. And then here it is, you know, and to what end, I don't know. I don't know if I see disaster coming, but it was nice to see them just so relaxed with one another.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just the, you know, the first swoony blushes of like an early fling or whatever. Or maybe it's something more significant. I just don't know.
I mean, it's funny, you know, because in the beginning of the episode, when both of them basically turn down their spouses on something like, oh, I can't, I have to go do this thing. I was like, oh, they're definitely doing this thing together because they only want to hang out with each other. And I was like, right. You know, like friends do. And sure. Then I was like,
so
no,
sweet, naive, Joanna.
Oh, Joanna. Anyway, so yeah, I'm here for it. They're like, and it wasn't, it's not just, you know, it's not just lust, right? There's like, they have the scene in the grocery store together. They have the scene in the commissary together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's a real relationship that's building there. And I like that for them. So, I mean, there's a lot of complications that come with it, but I still like it for them. And like, not like you mentioned that they discuss Nigeria. Jenny also says in that discussion of, I think it was like her aunt, she says something like she was that way. So not like 1,000% comfortable with homosexuality, I think, if you're going to say that way, you know what I mean, about someone. So,
well, no, yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, they're not marching in pride parades yet, but no.
Not yet. Give them time.
But, you know, and I think that from the casual, sexy kind of joy of their scenes together, that then leads to that really scary confrontation of sorts with Richard in their garage that was saying so much about their relationship and about Jenny's place in that, that I was, I didn't see the show kind of taking that dark of a turn, especially when it pertained to Richard. Maybe I should have with all the MAGA stuff, but, it was just, I think that like in the kind of last week's summary explosion and this week's sort of more fall, cold, windy thing, the lovely scenes between Maggie and Jenny were sort of, I think, thematically offset by actually both of those scenes of the two at home with their spouses, but that one in particular.
Yeah, and I mean, as part of that, you know, I don't want to not talk about that. I just want to like put this part in the middle of it, which is, I mean, I don't know if I just wasn't paying attention. But I feel like I was paying attention. So I feel like we all as an audience learned for the first time in this episode that Danny is not Richard's biological son. Right? I missed something.
No. Because it's mentioned kind of offhand early in this episode.
Yeah.
And then plainly stated later. And I kept rewinding, being like, what are they saying? And I really had not put that together.
Yeah.
But of course,
makes a lot of things make sense. Yeah. Yeah, his alienation from this family, like feeling like he's the like leftover from another family, so like that, the way that Richard treats him. We were really curious why Richard like was treating his daughter as like his only child when he had a son right there. And there's no excuse for it. It's not correct what Richard's doing, but like I understand in the framework of that character, you know, that makes sense psychologically for me.
Well, the basketball thing makes more sense from an earlier episode, and even the thing where he gets all up in Fraser's face about him breaking up the friend group, because here is someone who really like is struggling to feel like he has like a little unit, like a, you know, a tightly bound thing with other people, and then someone came in and kind of you know, threatened to destroy it.
And his bad relationship with Harper. You know what I mean? Like, if Harper gets all of Richard's attention, you know, like, a lot of things snapped into place around that for me. And also his fascination with Islam, if he, you know, believes that his father, you know, that this is part of his culture and his heritage, and he, you know, wants to separate himself from his MAGA father, MAGA stepdad, and explore that, you know, that to me also makes more sense. So I thought that was an, you're right, this, there's so much going on in this episode.
It's a really very, very big episode.
But we don't, I mean, we don't exactly know the full scope of what Danny's alluding to when he says to Jenny, like, how much are you willing to look the other way on in regards to Richard? Mm-hmm. So whenever someone says that, I'm like, what else is coming? Yeah. You know what I mean? So, okay. So, all right. So I got excited about the Jenny and Maggie thing. And I also got excited about the movie date. But you already, like, warned me that I probably shouldn't get excited because of age differences and Call Me By Your Name and discussions we've had and stuff like that.
It's so tough, though, because it was
really cute.
It was staged so well and it was acted so well.
Yeah.
And, like, I was watching it with my boyfriend, and he's been kind of, like, poking, you know, peering in and out on episodes as we've, you know, I watched it for this podcast.
Yeah.
And he was, like, trying to go about his day, and he had a Zoom call for work or something, and he just, like, stopped and, like, watched that whole thing while standing up holding something. And he had, like, it was just, like, it was, like, there you could tell there was something happening, you know. I don't really know how we're supposed to feel about that, but in its little vacuum of the pretend, you know, not the real world, I thought it was pretty sweet.
Yeah. I like the, it's just like the little smiles on their faces and just like the whole walk and talk that they did. I thought that was really good. I think Tom Mercier, I want to say, I Frenchified his name, is really good, I think. I hope not just because he's incredibly attractive. I also just think he's like a really, really just has a lot going on, you know, and you know, as does, Jack Dylan Grazer as Frasier. I think he also has a lot going on. So like, I really liked it.
Mercier, I believe, is the lead in a well-regarded, I think Israeli film from last year called Synonyms. So if people, want and see more of him, they can certainly. Those long arms, like his wrists are like at his knees, it's crazy.
It also makes more sense that he's in the army now because he has an American dad, so he has a U.S. passport, so that's why,
right? Yeah,
that he's an Israeli in the American
clarified
army.
Some stuff. A lot of clarifications in this episode. And I think that, you know, the walk and talk after the movie, the cute thing where they start walking backwards, like, I don't know, I saw shades of Before Sunrise in there, you know, that kind of oeuvre of just rambling dialogue-y relationship-y stuff. And, you know, we don't really know. I mean, I'm not trying to, like, qualify bad things, but, like, we don't quite know the age difference. It's entirely possible that this guy is 19 years old and Frasier's, what, 15, which, like, is still, you know, iffy, especially the authority thing. But, I don't know. I don't want to get into speculation about that. But, like, I think that scene in the library earlier where, you know, another book is exchanged, and then he kind of pats Frasier on the behind and Frasier's like reeling from that. That was when I was like, for the first time in this whole season, I was like, oh, something's definitely going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, this is not an accident. And then it was confirmed just a few minutes later.
And just like, sharing books, you know, and I like how Frasier's like, I don't understand why he likes this book, ? We did get an email about Jonathan. Okay, so like, I didn't get a chance to go back and watch the scene, so that's why I didn't read the email. But one of our listeners suggested that we watch the scene again where Sarah comes into the office and Jonathan is there watching the Clinton debate, because they said they thought there was something else going on with like a girl in that scene or something like that. I just need to rewatch it. But that listener was concerned that perhaps the I understand looking for danger around every corner in prestige television. You know, there's the background percolating a lot of sexual assault on this military base, yes, sort of, yeah, thing. So our listener was just flagging that sequence. I need to rewatch it to see what I think of it. But like, it would break my heart if Jonathan, who's a character I have tremendous affection for already, but it wouldn't be the first time TV has done that to me. So
I also think that, like, yeah, if I can just, yeah, opine for a second, like, without going into too much like intra-gay dialogue, like myself and gay friends have a very different take on like Call Me By Your Name than I think some straight people do.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time, the reason for that is that when you are gay or queer, whether or not you have a crush on someone older or not, it's really hard to have peers depending on where you are. And so that's why, like, a lot of teenagers kind of maybe they meet a college student or, right, you know, someone older in their town or whatever. And, like, yes, sometimes that does become a sexual relationship and that can be very compromised. So I'm not, like, advocating for that. I'm just saying that, like, that is why it happens, is because, like, otherwise you might not have anyone to relate to. And I think that what I like about the scenes during and post the movie in this episode is that they could just be setting up a kind of like lovely mentorship friend, you know, kind of friendship, like a sort of like older person and a younger person, like who like some of the same things and really get along, but for one of them is just a little further along in their development or something, you know. And I think that would be a totally realistic and you know, valid way for that relationship to play out on this show. But it is tricky territory. I think that the reason that I recognized it, or maybe Andrew recognized it when we were watching it this morning, was like, just like, oh, I was there once with so-and-so, you know, like,
yeah.
It is kind of a crucible or an experience that a lot of queer kids go through that might, I mean, not to like poo-poo the straight listeners or audiences of the show, but like that might just seem a little bit odd because, you know, they were a little bit less bereft of peers, I guess, mm-hmm, at that age.
Yeah, well, I will say, for the record, I had no issue with Call Me By Your Name, like the age difference there, until I was like told I was supposed to. There's been a ton of, you know, straight cinema where it's a young woman and an older man. Like, Stealing Beauty, I was reminded of Stealing Beauty with Liv Tyler, but I think her like romantic partner in that one is pretty young. But like, you know, if you want to look at like, this is, you know, as good as a Merchant Ivory film as we're going to get these days, and like Merchant Ivory is just filled with you know, young women and older men and stuff like that. So I, you know, I don't,
well, I'm watching screeners of the new season of The Crown.
Yeah,
Charles was like 32 and she was 19.
Yeah,
so
I know. I was listening to a podcast, You're Wrong About, have you listened to that podcast? Katie Rich is actually the one who got me invested in it. But they're doing like a couple Princess Diana episodes, and they mentioned something about like Charles meeting Diana when she was 5 and he was like a teenager. And you're like, what? It's like it's real like Prince Philip at the beginning of Sleeping Beauty looking at a literal baby sort of stuff, where you're just, oof, sort of like, whoa. Yeah. Anyway,
not,
so I like Call Me By Your Name.
I like this.
It could be that they're just setting up a mentor relationship. I think the minute he touches Fraser's necklace, that to me is even more intimate than like an ass slap in a library for some reason. So that's where I am on that. And then let's talk about there was something I wanted to hop to from that, and I don't remember what it was.
Harper State or?
No, let's talk about Harper State, which goes differently. And then once again, it reminds me of like when Dan Levy was talking about Schitt's Creek and how he invented, he, you know, he came up with a show that's set in a small town And he decided to skip the part where, like, there were homophobes in the town. Because he's like, guess what? We've seen that show. So that's just not what I wanted to do. Right. And so I think about that. Not that, you know, this is skipping that, because Richard is definitely representing that on this show. But, like, the idea of, like, my expectation last week was that the teen pool party was going to go horribly wrong. My expectation this week was that, like, Harper, in her attempt to create a mustache and shave her head and stuff like that, was going to be, like, discovered and exposed, and it was going to be awful. And instead, Julia, who's a cool chick who can hang, was just like, I know you're, I mean, whatever. I mean, maybe misgendered Harper in that moment, but, like, was like, whatever's clever, I'm down for it, mm-hmm. you know? And, you know, that upset Caitlin, and I can understand why, but, that's not the story we've seen over and over again, and I appreciated that.
No, it wasn't like the what the fuck, you're a
yeah.
you know, like,
yeah,
and
exactly.
I think that I like, you brace yourself for that because you've seen it so many goddamn times,
right?
But how disappointing for Harper, you know, to be like, am I passing? Like, is this happening, you know?
Yeah
and then it's not even just that, like, a discovery of, oh, you're, you know, but, like, it's like, oh, no, I knew the whole time, you know,
right.
And I think that would have to be crushing, you know.
I guess, I mean, yes, if Harper really is wanting to lean into a trans identity, which, you know, like, given, like, the desire to hold Fraser's, like, penis in a non-sexual way, but just in a, like,
yeah,
this is mine kind of way. I suppose points in that direction. But there's, like, a whole lot of gray in between there. And, you know, there's plenty of people who have found that they enjoy existing in the gray area as well.
Of course.
You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah. And I don't mean to imply that there is ever any sort of element of deception going on in that. It's just like from the context of the episode, it seemed like Harper was, like, trying something, you
yeah.
know, and had gotten this note addressed to Harper. And, you know, I was thinking about this, and I don't mean to be crass about it, but, like, this episode, there was a lot of Halloween imagery everywhere. And I was
yeah.
thinking about, like, costumes and, like, trying something else on and, like, becoming something else. And, like, I never would want to equate, you know, gender identity with any kind of costumery. It's not
at all.
But, like, but, you know, a kind of outward expression, if even for one night or something, you know, I think that that wasn't an accident either.
Yeah, the flashing light skull in the, you know, in Richard's kitchen was, like,
yeah, ominous.
Actually, I should probably call it Jenny's kitchen. Jenny's kitchen
with a lot of trash cans because she's conscientious, and Richard's horrible, disgusting bathroom.
I did want to mention this is the thing that I wanted to bring up earlier that I forgot, which is that the movie that they're watching on their date. Their non-date date, is Ouija, Origin of Evil, right?
Yeah.
Which was directed by Mike Flanagan,
who is
the man behind The Haunting of Bly Manor. So it all comes full circle back to ghosts, you know?
Well, that movie poster scene was funny because it was fun. I love, like, snapshots of a different era at the multiplex.
Yeah.
I mean, that was recent enough that it's not like, oh my God, all those movies were at the theaters at the same time. But I think there were little funny little bits within that moment. The kissing of Tom Hanks was great.
Love it.
But then that return to that lingering over Hacksaw Ridge.
I know.
Which, like, has cute boys in it. That's undeniable.
Uh-huh.
But also is this, like, incredibly annihilatingly violent war movie directed by Mel Gibson. Go on.
Well, I just can't, like, I've been thinking about that a lot this week because, you know, Mel Gibson's back in the news because he's got a trailer out or whatever. And I'm like, I don't want to watch it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. And I almost can't, like, I saw Hacksaw Ridge. We had to because it was an Oscar contender.
Yeah.
But that whole Oscar season still feels like a fever dream to me, because I was like, how do we just let that happen? How do we just let Mel Gibson back in through the prestige and front door?
Not even the Oscar nominations.
Yeah. Not even the comedy back door of, like, you know, Daddy's Home 2 or whatever, but the prestige front door of an Andrew Garfield war movie.
Come on in.
How did
in.
That happen?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like, what it would mean to be young on a military base in 2016 and see that something made far away, filmed in Australia, but an American film, that is just like reinforcing all the shit that you're dealing, like seeing day to day, would be really strange, you know, especially because it's about like something that happened 70 years prior.
Let's talk about standing for the national anthem before your movie starts playing.
You don't do that?
You want to talk about like weird.
I put my hand over my heart when it's like they're announcing the concession stand is open.
When they're like let's all go to the lobby. And you're
that's
like
my,
The other thing I want to mention very specifically that I thought was interesting is there's at least two scenes, maybe more, where Sarah takes someone else's drink. Sarah takes Jonathan's, like, starts drinking from Jonathan's Coke in the commissary, and then also takes Maggie's beer.
Yeah.
And, like, that's, you know, that's a classic, that seems like a very classic Sarah thing to do, to be honest with you. But then I thought it was interesting that, like, Jonathan gave his drink to Frasier. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, it's a nice little.
Well, Jonathan also like nodded him over at the theater. So like he's not trying to be clandestine about it, you know?
No.
And it's like, how much risk is actually being incurred here? I don't really know. So I thought that was interesting. But I also thought, you know, speaking of Sarah.
Yeah.
When she calls Richard over to apologize to the pizza store owner.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, oh, I heard you bought a new truck. Is it, you know, 350 horsepower? He's like 320. And she's like, blah, 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 kind of wheels. And he's like, no. And so he, like something lesser, you know. And in that scene, I kind of liked her power play.
Yeah.
But I don't like it in other places, which is like maybe something I need to invent. Like, I don't know. But like, it's just interesting
that they
include all the different facets of her, you know, sort of aggressive personality, I guess.
I mean, I don't know if you were saying that because, like, you're wondering if there's some, you know, undercurrent of misogyny in your rejection of some of her power plays. But, you know, as our token woman on this podcast, I'll say that, like, Sarah's, you know, just like Frasier, Sarah's shit sometimes is intolerable, like, it's awful. And then sometimes you're like, who's the bad boss bitch here, you know? So it's a mixed bag with her.
There's also a race dynamic, you know,
that
I don't know how much the show doesn't really feel like it's gotten into much of that. Maybe it will, but that's also, you know, definitely prevalent. In terms of power structures and all that stuff.
Well, I think in casting Richard, you know, in making Richard the, like, you know, MAGA conservative, that complicates everything. Once again, it's not interested in serving us up a type that we're familiar with, right?
Right.
Sarah, similarly, is just not a type we're familiar with, necessarily. Should we talk about Sarah's, like, doing gun range practice with Harper and how we feel about that?
Yeah. I love the, I don't know. It's a dynamic. I can't really think about anything in specific. Maybe Enough Said, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Nicole Hall of Center movie,
mm-hmm.
Where the friend appreciates your parents so much more than you do, you know? And Harper says to Frasier, she's totally wasted on you, you know?
Yeah.
I just think it's like a very credible kind of thing. I mean, even now when I have like friends up to see my, you know, for like a long weekend with my folks or whatever, and it's just all this gushing praise from my parents, which is lovely to hear, and I agree with like 75% of it, but you know, there's that other 25% you're like, you have no idea. You know, and I just think that's like a very like relatable kind of friend to parent dynamic.
Yeah, it's and similarly, I was just saying, I find some of Frasier's behavior intolerable. Like, I don't understand what he was saying to Maggie when he was like, "I can't decide if I hate you," and Maggie responded like perfectly to that, which was not to take him seriously, which is great. But But I will say, probably people watching did not respond well to him, like, typing C-U-N-T in all caps at Sarah in a text message. But I was like, I can kind of relate to that, like, where are your boundaries to a parent? Yeah. You know what I mean? And, like, I have asked you repeatedly to stay out of my life in this way. You have so much. Can you not give me this?
And not just that Sarah and Harper are spending time together, but almost have a secret together.
Right.
Like, that is, like, intimate, you know? Yeah. But with the other thing you mentioned, he was just saying, I'll see you next Tuesday, because they had, like, a plan, I think. That's okay. Yeah, it's teen tech speech, right?
I'm not talking to you for 11 days, so I'll see you next Tuesday, right. Which is 11 days from now.
Well, in Italy, the weeks, they're
or 11 days. Yeah. I know. Yeah. Okay. is there anything else we want to talk about? Did we talk enough about what happened with Richard and Jenny? I don't know if we want to talk about that.
I don't know how much I want to wade into it. I mean, yeah. it was very bracing, you know, yeah. And I think that I will say that Faith Alabi is so terrific in that scene, as hard as it must have been to perform. Yeah. And I just love her presence in this episode in general, as well as Alice Braga's. You know, and I was thinking also about Scott Mascuti, who, like, has this whole other career as a musician and, like, has been kind of a lovable, cool guy on the scene for so long. Like, to really commit to playing this character who has absolute human shading, but, like, is also kind of scary and aggressive. And, like, I think that I would hope that both of those actors in that really, you know, kind of wretched scene had the full sort of trust in their director and their environment to film that. I would think so, to get where they did with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's upsetting on its own, and then in juxtaposition with what happens with Maggie and Sarah, because, you know, basically both Maggie and Jenny are coming home from a sexual affair, and both have a sexual encounter then with their spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And for Jenny, it's assault, I would say. And, you know, and then for, you know, Maggie, there might be some reluctance there. But ultimately, that felt consensual to me. You know what I mean? So that, to me, makes me worried for Jenny in terms of, like, you know, Maggie, I don't think, is looking to, like, bail out of this marriage necessarily. And what does that mean for Jenny? I don't know.
So. It illustrates the stakes and how they're different for each character in a pretty brutal way, but, you know, an efficient way too.
All right. I am going to check in now on the teen romance front, right? Okay. So Danny is out in public with Valentina, who last week married Craig. So that's happening, whatever that is. And then, speaking of Craig, Craig's younger brother, Sam, who was dating Harper, is now dating Brittany, and Brittany is claiming that she's in love with him and always has been.
Yeah, always has.
Always has.
And what does Harper say? Okay. Sure. No, she said sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sure, fine.
And then walks away. Brutal.
I don't know. Once again, that felt like I think I need to learn from these characters sometimes is, like, a non-response, because that's sort of like what what Maggie pulled when Fraser got in her face. Okay, fine, whatever. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Whatever.
But I almost think with that Maggie thing.
Yeah.
It's going to make me come down too hard on Sarah. I almost think it's partly because Maggie is not so much of a narcissist to think it means something. You know, it's not like the biggest deal in the world. I know that Sarah also kind of treats Fraser's outburst kind of casually, but I think the ability for her just to be like, okay, like, just projected a bit more of a security.
Self, you know? I think that's true. And confidence in their loving relationship. Yeah. All right. I think we did it.
Yeah, we kind of hopped all over, but there was so much plot that we couldn't just wax semi-poetic about war, I guess.
I don't think we missed anything major, but if we did, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Once again, check your feeds for Haunting of Bly Manor special episode on Tuesday this week, and then we will be back next Monday. Richard, until then, where can folks find you?
Ugh, I wish at a movie theater, you know, Aww. Just having some sort of cutie flirty moment.
I know. Do you think they like brushed knuckles during the scary parts?
Oh, yeah, probably. I mean, you know, why else go to a scary movie?
Love a knuckle brush. Okay.
Yeah. But no, barring that, I guess I'll just be fucking online, Twitter, Rylaws, and writing for VF.com. Until we head back to autumnal Italy, Joanna, where will you be?
Well, I'd like to say that I'll be on the back of my brand new truck.
Oh, yeah. Your beer-soaked truck?
Holding court to my my employees. Actually, I will just be online at Joe Rothes on Twitter and on VF.com. And we will talk to you all next week.
Ciao.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.